Are you looking for new books to read? Do you like finding a new special author? Are you tired of the same old books from the same old authors? Well then, welcome to Discovered Wordsmiths, a podcast where you can hear from fantastic new authors. Join Stephen Schneider as he finds and talks to authors you may not know, but authors that have worked hard to write great new books. Hear about their book and why you should check it out. So sit back and listen to today's Discovered Wordsmith.
Late December, the year zero. The trees were barren. The country and side roads of eastern Ohio were covered in a patchwork blanket of partly melted and refrozen snow. A hybrid car cruised on gas power along a generally northward path up the winding trail through the Appalachian foothills. The car was driven by a careful black man who turned 27 at some uncelebrated time in the past month. Next to him sat a white man roughly twice his age, who was trying with little success to connect a cellular phone to the aux port of the car. Behind them sat a little girl, the black man's daughter. To a casual observer, she would appear to be playing with a tablet computer. Just three people out for a drive in the country on a pleasant winter day. A triumphant look of satisfaction came over the white man as music, Charlie Daniels, began to play through the car speakers. He smiled, his gnarled and unkempt facial hair parting to show surprisingly well-maintained teeth. "If nothing interrupts our trip," he declared, "we'll reach the Lake Erie shore in a matter of hours, maybe slightly after noon." The driver held up his hand to display crossed fingers. The little girl interrupted.
"Bogey up ahead,"
she declared, shaking her head to indicate that the ETA the white man had just so hopefully announced was overly optimistic.
"Headed our direction. Two clicks."
The driver switched over to electric power as the white man turned off the music.
"Should we pull over here?" the white man asked.
The little girl's father looked over his shoulder to gauge the opinion of his daughter, their spotter. She looked up from the tablet to give a barely discernible shrug. Her face twisted slightly and her eyes half closed noncommittally. The driver glanced to his left at the tree line.
"No," he said. "There's still far enough ahead that we can afford to close the gap some and find a safer spot to enter the woods. We can drive another mile or so before taking action."
Almost 2 minutes of tense travel later, the little girl said, "We're close now. If we get much closer, we'll hear them before we can get far enough away."
They found a safe place to pull to the side of the road. A truck pullover on the sheer side of the hill to their right. A copse of trees on mostly level ground to their left. The driver powered the car down, exited the vehicle, and opened the rear driver's side door, allowing his daughter to exit without having to take her eyes from the tablet. A moment later, she used the device to land the small drone she'd been using to monitor their path, which they retrieved before all three entered the woods on the west side of the road. The white man had gone in ahead of them, clearing the way with a machete. Had the drone remained airborne, it would now show them the motley group of people shambling southward on the blacktop toward their location. Had the drone been mic'd, it would have picked up the strange atonal hum of their voices, which was really the most dangerous thing about them. Their choreographed movement was off-putting and out of place. Their lifeless stare and slack but twitching jaws were frightening and surreal. Their apparent purposeful progress and mindless intent, well, creepy is really the best word to describe that. But our trio knew that none of that could harm them. It was the sound they made that did the damage. The sound would lure you, then kill you, then transform you. A few hundred feet into the woods, the trees broke into a clearing. They crossed the grassy and snowy field, giving them significant berth from their car, as well as from the mindless flock. The little girl again raised the drone and watched the progress of the milling crowd on her tablet. When the mob had cleared the car and gone an extra quarter mile, they returned to their ride and resumed their journey. It had taken the better part of 4 hours. They would not be reaching the lake by noon.
"The sun is getting low in the sky," the white man said as they reached the Painesville city limit.
They had chanced the main road in the rural area, but had opted for the more pastoral roads when they approached the previously more densely populated hubs.
"It'll be getting dark in about an hour or so. I don't think we can make it safely to the harbor before dark. A lot of people lived here, so a lot of people died here, so a lot of those things patrol here."
"We can't stay exposed like this," the driver said. "We'll have to find a safe, tall building to camp in till morning. The higher up we go, the further we'll be from their sounds. Chloe, get a fresh drone up and do your thing. Find us a high-rise or something,"
he said to his daughter in the back seat. The little girl got a fresh drone from the trunk, and after a few minutes, she had it airborne. Soon she had an image from a good height, showing that the landscape was dotted with distant threats. There were two primary hubs of congregated dead, moving in and out in two pulsating mobs, one in a hospital complex's parking area, and another in the lot of a shopping mall. This was a phenomenon they had witnessed several times over the past months, but the drone gave a new perspective. The dead they had observed somehow always seemed to gather in large open spaces, where they would slowly stroll about in a trance-like choreography, as though they had a purpose and intention to their movements, despite their minds being obviously absent. The hive-like aspect of this behavior was undeniable, as individuals that hit obstacles would cause a ripple in that segment of the overall unit, which would then gradually translate into the entire mob having a new synchronized composition of movement. There was another characteristic of the thing's choreography they had frequently observed. At the extremities of the amassed crowds, the outermost members would sometimes find themselves thrust outward by the structure of the dance, where a half dozen or so would be pinched off here and there from their respective segments of the mob, forming a subgroup which would then head out on what they had come to call a patrol. Consequently, several small groups of wandering weirdos were making their way down various streets, which Chloe's team would easily avoid in their now silently running vehicle. The drone's camera showed a handful of patrols on a variety of side and connecting streets, as well as three on nearby main thoroughfares. But they were distant enough for now, each group moving generally forward, weaving in and out of each other's paths as they tended to do as they migrated, occasionally bumping into a fire plug or a utility pole or the corner of a building, which would cause them to hesitate and blindly restructure their course. Eventually, this group would find and join up with another patrol, and this now larger patrol would create a new dance and chart a new course, which would ultimately take them to one of the large gatherings, where they would join that choreography until happenstance again pinched them off in a new patrol. Experience also told them that these patrols were not just following their own choreography, but they were, for want of a better term, singing. None of the passengers who had just arrived on the scene had ever actually heard the song. They had spent the last year actively avoiding it, so they couldn't describe it even if they wanted to. They had seen the song's purpose, though. They had witnessed its terrible effect. Then, as they watched the milling and meandering tours, the little girl spotted something weird, even for this reality. A few blocks from their current location, deeper into the city, relatively close to the hospital complex, there was a man like themselves. A human man. A living man. He wasn't part of a patrol. He wasn't wandering, dancing, or singing. He was alive. And he was right in the path of a distant but oncoming patrol. He looked to be homeless, pushing a shopping cart toward a dumpster behind a gas station. She showed her father a pleading look in her eyes.
He doesn't know they're coming.
The two men exchanged a long glance.
He's not our problem, said the white man. But I don't want to watch him die if we can help. Is there time?
That depends on him, said the little girl's father. Who knows what his reaction would be to us driving up on him?
Look at it this way, the little girl said. Maybe he can help us. He survived somehow. Maybe he has some trick for avoiding the zombies he could teach us.
Again, the two men shared a prolonged glance. Finally, the white man shrugged.
She's got a point.
Maneuvering the streets to reach the man took only a few minutes. They were safe to drive quickly, as the hybrid car ran almost silently. They had all witnessed the reactions of the creatures when assaulted by the sound of machinery or gunfire. Most sounds of nature failed to elicit a reaction, with a few exceptions, such as the screeching of eagles or the call of cicadas. But there was something about the sound of machinery, music, and other sounds not found in nature, sounds which carried and overpowered the sound of their song, that agitated the dead. So it was essential that they not startle the man, that they not slam doors or squeal tires, and that, after they warned him, they drive as far from the dead as possible before the patrol got to within earshot. Pulling to a stop on the street across from the mini-mart, where the stranger was tossing bags from the dumpster to near a shopping cart he'd found somewhere, they settled on a strategy. It would be too weird, they thought, to have the little girl called Chloe walk up on the man. Imagine you've seen nobody alive for who knows how long, and suddenly, out of the blue, a child appears to say hi. No, that's a horror movie trope you don't want to experience in real life. Yet, no matter what tactic they chose to introduce themselves to the man, it was going to be a shock. So why not go with the horror movie trope? At least she didn't represent the same threat as two adult males suddenly showing up. The drone transmission showed the patrol was closing the space between. They probably had only a few minutes to convince the fellow of his danger before the sound of the Song of the Dead became audible. Deciding to waste no more time strategizing, they all climbed into the car and drove up on the dumpster. To their surprise, the man in the trash box simply glanced up and waved, then went back about his business. Chloe's father rolled down the window and whisper-shouted,
"Sir, sir, what are you doing?"
"It's okay," the man said. "I'll clean the mess. I just need water." "You'll be surprised how many people toss full bottles of perfectly good drinking water."
"Well, full or nearly full."
The two men in the car struggled to understand. The little girl called Chloe simply found her curiosity aroused. She rolled down her window as well and stuck her head out.
"How did you know about that?"
she asked. The man stopped his work.
"What?"
Chloe clarified her question.
"How did you know you could find water bottles in the trash?"
"Oh," the man said, jumping to the ground and pulling a few bottles from the plastic bags at his feet. "I used to work here. It was my first job after high school. At first, I was angry about the water bottles, because when I collected the bags from the receptacles to bring back to the dumpster, they were just extra unnecessary weight. But then, I realized I could use the water to refill the windshield washer fluid rather than going inside and getting a heavy bucket of water. But in the winter, we filled those with washer fluid, you know, the blue liquid. So when it snowed, I started leaving the water out for the stray cats that lived around the back and hung out in the dumpsters."
"Aw,"
the little girl said.
"Why do you need the water?"
the white man asked.
"Huh?"
the dumpster diver said.
"Oh, because my water system was damaged. I didn't plan on using the dumpster water, but the store is closed, so..."
"The store is closed?"
Chloe's father asked, not understanding exactly what this man thought was going on.
"All the stores are closed,"
the white man said.
"Do you not know what's been happening?"
"How long have you been out here?"
the little girl asked.
"Not long," the new man said. "An hour, maybe? My house is not far from here, so I came into town to get Christmas presents for my parents and decided to stop for water first."
"Your parents?"
asked the white man.
"Are your parents still alive?"
asked Chloe's father. The odd man in the trash can chuckled.
"Last time I checked," he said.
Again, there was a confused exchange of glances.
"When was that exactly?"
asked Chloe's father. The trash man's eyes rolled back slightly, ponderously.
9 months ago, maybe?"
"Sir," Chloe's father said, "my name is Andrew Moore, and this is my daughter Chloe and my friend Mark Bell. May I ask what your name is?"
"Sure,"
the man in the trash said as he stepped toward the car.
"My name is Philip Torres. It's my pleasure to meet you."
He rubbed his hands on his coat.
"Excuse me for not shaking your hand."
"Philip," Andrew said, "I'm not entirely sure you understand the present situation, but you are currently in great danger."
"You said you have a house?"
Mark asked.
"Yes, it's the home I grew up in. It's just up on that hill, a little over a mile from here."
"Is it some kind of survivalist bunker?"
Mark asked.
"Something like that," Philip said. "I've retrofitted it to be entirely self-sufficient. Solar-powered, a rain reservoir, gated. I mean, it's not a fortress or anything. My parents live in a retirement community in Lakewood. That's where I was headed."
"You won't make it," Andrew interrupted. "Show him, sweetie," he said to the girl called Chloe.
The little girl showed him her tablet, explaining that the image he was seeing was from a drone a few blocks away. The monitor showed a strangely shambling group of dirty and broken-looking people heading their way.
"If those people get close enough that we can hear them, we'll all be dead. I mean, it's over. You'll die, and then you'll be one of them." "You said you drove here?"
Andrew asked, but it really wasn't a question.
"Get in your car and drive home now. We will follow you at a safe distance. Here, take this walkie-talkie so we can alert you of any danger ahead."
The stranger was obviously confused and uncertain, but the agitation and forceful manner of the way his orders had been delivered caused him to feel he had no choice but to acquiesce. The new people followed as he walked around the building to his Lamborghini Hurricane and sat behind the wheel. Then he turned the ignition and revved the engine. Each of the new people, both men and the little girl, threw up their hands and stepped forward, making shushing noises with contorted faces. "Don't," one whisper shouted. "Stop," exclaimed another in a sotto voice. The third simply made slashing motions under his chin. The little girl looked at her tablet as her eyes widened, and she held the screen up for the others to see. The creatures were incensed. The sound of the revving engine had echoed to their senses, and they had increased their speed. They still had to correct errors to their path. Running was not something they were capable of, as they seemed to only navigate as a group, calculating a path around obstacles based on a general agreement between constituent parts of a company as a whole. Still, they would arrive eventually, and now they would zero in on the source of the sound that had interfered with their song.
"Go that way,"
Andrew whispered to the driver of the Hurricane.
"Head up to your house. We'll follow, and if we see a threat, we'll redirect you over the walkie."
The small caravan set off, slowly maneuvering the abandoned streets. Soon the little girl saw on her tablet that a group of the undead was changing course, rounding a corner ahead and coming their way. If they remained on this course, they'd be in earshot in a matter of minutes. The problem was, the best escape route was up a steep slope, and the other driver's engine would probably rev as the car shifted down to make the incline. Andrew made a command decision. He radioed the stranger to stop, and he pulled the hybrid alongside the sports car, signaling the driver to roll his window down.
"We'll leave your car here for a few minutes until the things pass. And when it's safe, we'll come back for it and continue on our way."
Turning on the side street, they moved to the safer region, abandoning the Lamborghini for the time being. The plan was to retrieve Torres' car when it was safe. However, they were now forced to come up with a new route on streets unfamiliar to them and to their newest passenger, who claimed to have never driven in this neighborhood before, all as dozens of cells of the creatures roamed the neighborhoods, altering course at will. Then, suddenly, everything changed. The unmistakable sound of a car alarm began echoing off the city walls. Taurus's car had been bumped by the passing group of zombies, and the anti-theft siren had been activated. It shrilled in a wail that echoed around the otherwise silent city buildings, and every pod of roaming goons for what seemed like a mile-and-a-half radius around the blaring car, at least those scattered groups of creatures that were close enough to hear the distant alarm, began moving erratically, arresting their forward progress, as the creatures that had set off the alarm fell upon the noisy machine and attempted to dismantle or overturn it. The drone clearly showed that the more distant patrols hadn't turned their attention to the source of the sound, their ability to navigate apparently temporarily broken by the noise. Probably, Andrew thought, because the echoing racket was non-directional, reaching their ears from conflicting origins. Whatever the reason, though, it represented an opportunity to flee. The closest monsters were preoccupied with the Hurricane, and any other nearby patrols were frozen in place. Taking advantage of the opportunity, they hurried in the direction of the stranger's house, relying on a combination of his familiarity with the city and the little girl's assurances that the course was clear. Arriving at the gated estate, Philip entered a code into a pin pad which granted them entrance, and as they reached the door, he showed them inside. Once within, Philip apologized that he was unable to offer them the opportunity to freshen up, but as he'd mentioned, his water collection system was on the fritz, which was all the more unfortunate as, due to his time in the dumpster, Philip currently smelled worse than the death they'd been smelling for the better part of the current year.
"Is it really Christmas time?" the little girl asked.
Philip didn't understand the question and asked for clarification.
"You said that you were going to get presents for your family. We all lost track of the date a long time ago," she answered.
Philip explained that his computer had a built-in calendar, and he'd been keeping track of time with it so he could see how long it had taken him to compose his album.
"We just knew it was winter," the little girl said. "But if it's Christmas time, that means it will be New Year soon. That's going to be year one."
"She's been calling this year the year zero," her father explained. "She's convinced herself that there will be a fresh beginning in the year one."
Philip's jaw had fallen at some point during the explanation, and he nodded open-mouthed.
"What are those things?" Philip asked, changing the topic to something more present. "What exactly happened?"
"How do you not know?" Mark asked, speaking again for the first time in a while. "You have a computer, a television."
"I'm off-grid," Philip explained. "I've been on a several months-long media blackout as I worked on my album."
He pointed to a corner of his main living area, where he had bass traps in the corners and foam sound-damping blocks on the walls.
"I'm a musician from a wealthy family who... it's complicated. I have no friends, really, and I'm an only child. I've been taking care of my parents for a few years, but finally I had to put them in long-term care a little over a year ago. Afterwards, I was kind of lost, so I decided to self-seclude and focus on my art. I had the house worked on so I could be self-sufficient. I bought enough food for a year. I locked myself in, and I've been writing music ever since. I know how weird it sounds, but I thought it would be an interesting story. I hoped it would sell records. This whole time I've stayed off the net. I got rid of my cell phone. I have movies, but no cable, no radio. And my only distraction is my playthings in the cellar. I do have a DVR to record the local news from an analog antenna so I could catch up on current events before I rejoin society, but when I checked it earlier, I realized the DVR stopped recording some time ago. I assume the antenna blew over or something." Andrew, who had been listening intently, was shaken from his reverie, prodded to a more proactive mindset.
so you might have news reports from when things went bad. Everything started happening in March. Can you go back that far?
Philip raised his remote from the end table, brought his television to life, and scrolled the menu to the listings for mid-March. The Ides. The news reporter gravely described that the nation had been attacked. The government, he said, suspects Russia has somehow planted a biological weapon in numerous locations around the Midwest, which is causing people to behave erratically. It was not known, he explained, how the disease, if it was a disease, was spread, nor how many people had been affected. But several rural areas and a few minor metropolitan ones in Michigan and Indiana had gone completely dark. Attempts had been made to assess the situation, but none of the teams had reported back. They selected another broadcast from a few days later. Reports explained that the government had ordered everyone to evacuate to the nearest coast, and the military would put people on ocean liners and military ships until they knew what was happening. They were then shown drone footage of a football field in Indianapolis, where for unknown reasons a group of people had gathered. The reporter remarked that they seemed to be walking in patterns in flux. The image on the screen confirmed his observation. The unobscured, open field gave the mob birth to move in a continuous pattern. The mass of bodies was moving in a pulsating arrangement, forming a circular mass that defaulted to a hexagonal curved and rotating shape in the center that extended outward in branches from each apex. It looked like a kaleidoscopic snowflake made up of tens of thousands of moving human bodies.
"I've seen something like that before when I was studying acoustics," Philip said. "If you put powder on a speaker membrane and add sound, the powder will form a pattern, like choreography, and the pattern will change as you raise or lower the decibel level and hertz. The people in that field look choreographed the same way."
Another report from the end of March cut to a live report from the coast as people crowded around fencing at the harbor trying to secure a place on one of the government commandeered ships. The reporter on the scene explained that the military had seized any ocean-going vessels it could, whether commercial, privately owned, or even state or local government vessels, for use as floating sanctuaries. The plan was to sail them with as many citizens as they could safely carry to the edge of national waters, where they would moor and attempt to wait out the epidemic. Andrew explained that this was where he had been trying to get to. He and Chloe, he said, had left Indiana on foot after barely escaping an attack by those things, and they had seen firsthand that most of the refugees who had tried to drive east had not made it. They continued watching what few news reports remained and learned that many of the ships had gone radio silent and that several of the ports had likewise stopped communicating. The pundits suspected Russian interference, and the fear that they were experiencing was profoundly evident. Reporters had begun warning those people who had chosen to remain to prepare for the worst, many describing their own survival plans and referencing their own inability to contact family members. In early April, a newscaster who was apparently alone in his studio, acting as director, technician, and camera operator, wished everyone good luck in a final sign-off.
"Maybe the survivalists who built underground shelters had the right idea," he said. "I wish I had better advice for you. But the truth is, I don't think I'm going to make it out of this studio tonight, or ever. Any viewers still watching, if you haven't made plans to flee to the coast, or if the coast is too far, perhaps find open country and signal any passing planes. I really don't know what to suggest anymore. Good luck to you all."
He stood and walked off camera, and shortly the signal flickered out. There were no more broadcasts. Philip switched off the television, and Mark broke the silence.
"It's unlikely there is anybody at the lake shore waiting with a boat. Either they will have all sailed away or been overrun by now."
Andrew pulled his daughter in closer and rested his chin on her head, an expression of resignation to failure in his eyes. Philip was in shock.
"I still don't understand what happened," he said.
Andrew attempted an explanation.
"It has to do with the sound those things make," he said. "If you're close enough to hear it, you begin convulsing and writhing in pain, but only for moments before it apparently kills you. Only you don't stay dead. In a matter of just minutes, you stand up and look for a herd of other dead people to join. It's literally the zombie apocalypse, but without the flesh-eating."
"They call you, too," the little girl said. "The sound they make. Somehow, it makes you think it's calling you. You hear your name, in your head, and it makes you want to get closer."
"That's true," Mark said. "I've seen that, too. Even if you know it's not really calling, you go because it's your name being called."
"That can't be accurate," Philip insisted. "How can they be dead but not dead? Don't they need food and a working nervous system?"
They'll probably stop operating eventually, Mark said. Decay and dehydration will take care of that. But the working nervous system part is not uncommon among dead things in nature. Have you ever heard of a fungus called Ophiocordyceps unilateralis?
Philip said he had not. Mark explained.
It parasitizes ants in the tropics. Its spores find a host ant and kills it while taking control of the nervous system. Then it operates the dead ant like a puppet or a robot.
As he spoke, he lay back on the couch. Closing his eyes, he said,
I have a sleep headache. I need some shut-eye soon. Anyway, the dead ant climbs a tree and grabs hold of a leaf, all because the fungus basically tells it to. And after the fungus matures, it drops more spores on more ants below and makes more zombie ants.
This isn't fungal, Andrew said. It's not organic at all. It's not magic, and it's not biological. It's mathematical, fractals, and patterns are involved.
And loud unnatural sounds disorient them, Philip observed. The group fell into an uncomfortable silence. Philip sat rocking in place, thinking. Finally, he stood.
My family has a boat, Philip announced, in an almost whisper.
The others looked at him expectantly.
It won't be easy to get to it. It's in a storage locker a mile from the shore.
He wasn't sure what the others were gathering from his words, but he pressed on.
We will have to get to the locker and then hitch the boat, drive it to the docks, maneuver it into the slipway, then launch.
He saw them staring at him and concluded,
But I think it's worth a shot.
Thank you for listening to Discovered Wordsmiths. Come back next week and listen to another author discuss the road they've traveled, and maybe, sometime in the near future, it might be you.